Let's start. Today is the last lecture that I'm going to do, and then Cameron is going to take over on Thursday. So today we're going to finish essentially what we started last time, talking about tangent vectors, cotangent vectors, and tensors. But before, a quick detour on continuous and smooth functions between manifolds, because we're going to need them to define tensor fields, vector fields, and so on. So we start with these continuous and smooth maps. Then we'll talk about the tangent, cotangent, tensor bundle, which is where the fields are going to live. Before we start, are there any questions about the previous lecture? OK, then let's start. Now, suppose that we have two manifolds, M and N, with atlases AM, AN. Now we have a function that goes between one manifold to the other. And we want to decide if this function is continuous or smooth. How do we do that? Because so far, we only know how to do this from functions that go to Rn to Rm, but not between manifolds. Any ideas of what we can do to figure out if this function is continuous, for example?
Back.
Yes, so we're going to do everything in Rn. So the whole idea of manifolds is that they locally look like Rn. So we're going to just check every single thing about them in Rn rather than checking with the manifolds, because we don't know how to do that. As we've seen examples of manifolds, there are weird spaces that contain equivalence classes of things. They are not things that we can easily think of as being points in Rn unless we have charts. Okay, so the first definition that we're going to use is continuity at a single point, not everywhere, just at the point. So the function f we defined above, but really just a function between m and n, we didn't define anything. We're going to say it's continuous at a point p in m if for any charts u phi, and this is a chart in M, so it belongs to the atlas of M, n chart v psi, which is a chart in the manifold N, with the only requirement that u contains p and v contains phi of p. So they are charts that cover the point and the image of the point. Then these functions are continuous, all of them. We call these the coordinate representations. Of f, because it's essentially telling us in coordinates what f does. Now, this is probably easier to understand by looking at this picture. And I can zoom in on it a little bit so you can see better. So the idea is that we have the manifolds m and n. We have a map f that goes from m to n. This is our point, p. That's mapped to f of p. And we have this u, which is the set of the chart u phi, that contains p, and v contains f of p. So while we can go from here to here, we also have a way of going back and forth between m and Rn. I'm assuming that n is the dimension of m, and m is the dimension of n, which I realize is a bit weird because I swapped letters, but it's too late now. So we can go back and forth here. We can go down using phi, but back using phi to the minus 1, and similarly here. So instead of going in this direction, we can go the other way around, which is essentially this one. So we have two ways of going from here to here. And because we already know that, in a sense, these maps are smooth and this map is smooth, it does make sense to define smoothness of f as smoothness of this map here. Because if this is smooth, then we're composing it with two other smooth maps, and everything is fine. So that's going to be our definition. This is about continuity, although smoothness works exactly the same. So all of this, replace what I've said with smooth, with continuous. At the moment, we're trying to find out if something is continuous. So just one note to this. I said here that this must happen for all charts containing the points. And also, it should be F of P. This should happen for all charts, but in fact, it's enough that this happens in one pair of charts. So if there is one chart U phi and one chart V psi where this happens, then this happens for all of them. Just because the transition maps are going to be continuous, you just, for any other map, you use the transition maps to prove this. So if you were actually trying to check if something is continuous at the point, you only need to find one chart for P, one chart for F of P, and check it there. If it works, then you're fine. You don't have to check every possible chart. Any questions about this?
So the reason why it is enough to check a single pair of charts is that the change of coordinates is always by definition smooth.
Yes, exactly. So if you check it in one chart and then you have another chart, because the transition maps that are the way to go from one chart to the other are always continuous, otherwise it's not an atlas, then if you were to try to find, if you had another chart, psi prime, phi prime, then you can always essentially insert and remove psi composed with psi to the minus one, which is the identity, and then the transition map is continuous. Maybe I should just write this down. So if you were trying to do this, you have a different map. You have this composed F, composed phi prime to the minus one, where psi prime and phi prime are different maps, different charts, then you can always write these as psi prime composed psi composed, composed psi to the minus one composed psi, composed f composed. And here you're going to have phi to the minus one composed phi composed phi prime to the minus one. I'm just inserting and removing identities, which I can do, because these things are just identities, but then you group them differently, and this thing is continuous because it's a transition function. This is continuous because it's a transition function, and this is continuous because that's where you're starting from. So if it's continuous, if this is continuous, then this is continuous. So you check it in one chart, it's going to be true in all of them, which is great from practical purposes because it saves you a lot of time. Essentially because you can have infinitely many charts and then you cannot actually check all of them. Okay, so once we have continuity at a point, then it's easy to generalize this to the whole manifold. So a function from M to N is continuous on the whole domain M if it is continuous at each one of its points. And similarly, we can define smooth functions. It's exactly the same as these definitions from above. Just replace continuous with smooth everywhere. So f is going to be smooth at a point if, when you have two charts, u phi and v psi, they contain the point p and f of p. Then now the coordinate representation function, the psi composed f composed pi to the minus one, this should be a class c infinity instead of just being continuous. So again, you just check whether it is c infinity in the coordinate representation, and then you say that it is actually smooth as a map between manifolds. And just as before, the proof is the same. If it is true in one pair of charts, it's true in all of them. And just as continuity on the whole manifold, f is smooth on M if it is smooth at each point. So this is how we define smoothness and continuity of functions. Now, just one note, continuity can actually be defined in a different way that does not involve charts, and that has to do with topological spaces. But since we only care about topological manifolds, this is enough, so you don't have to actually deal with the topology as a collection of open sets. But there is another way of defining continuity if you're interested. Now that we have this, we're going to just briefly look at a specific kind of continuous and smooth functions, which is very important in topology and differential geometry. And these are the isomorphisms for topological manifolds and for smooth manifolds. So isomorphisms, just like the ones you've seen in linear algebra for vector spaces, are just essentially invertible maps that preserve the structure. So if we have a function f between two manifolds m and n, which is invertible, first of all, and also satisfies this thing, both the function itself and its inverse are continuous. This is also known as being bicontinuous. Then we're going to say that the function f is a homeomorphism, which is the name that we use for isomorphisms between topological manifolds. Two manifolds are going to be homeomorphic if there is an isomorphism between them. And similarly, we're going to do the same thing for the differential structure. We're going to say that that the function is a diffeomorphism if it is invertible, and both f and f to the minus 1 are smooth functions. And two manifolds are diffeomorphic if they have a diffeomorphism between them. So these notions are exactly the isomorphisms, if you know anything about category theory, of the categories of topological manifolds and smooth manifolds. And essentially, this just means that they are the functions that preserve all of the structure. One thing to note that's different for example, the isomorphisms for vector spaces is that you need both f and the inverse to be continuous and or smooth. While, for example, for vector spaces, you just need the function to be invertible and linear, and it's an isomorphism. And this is simply because for continuity and smoothness, you can have functions which are continuous and invertible, and the inverse is not continuous. Or smooth and invertible, and the inverse is not smooth. So this is something that can happen, so we need to require that in both directions, you have this property. One interesting note about this, it should be clear from the definition that if two manifolds are diffeomorphic, then they're also homeomorphic, because any smooth function is also a continuous function. The other way around is not true, and there are manifolds which are homeomorphic but not diffeomorphic. This is very interesting because it was not obvious at all, because in many examples, especially in low dimensions, you build manifolds, and once you have two homeomorphic manifolds, there's only one way you can make them into smooth manifolds. So they end up also being diffeomorphic. But in higher dimensions, you can actually build weird spaces that have the same geometrical structure in terms of topology, but two different differential structure that you can add on them.
So there can be more than one homeomorphism for given M, N.
Yes, you can have more than one homeomorphism, just as for vector spaces, you can have more than one isomorphism. So you just need to have one. If there is one, then they are homeomorphic. And you can have, of course, many more than just one. Same for diffeomorphism. So just to recap, these homeomorphisms are maps that preserve the topological structure, just how vector space isomorphisms preserve the vector space structure. And diffeomorphism preserve the differential structure. Now, topological structure, remember, it tells us about things such as whether the space has any holes in it, or if it has a boundary, and things like that. The diffeomorphism preserve the differential structure, which is things like what we defined using differential structure, so tangent spaces, cotangent spaces, and so on. Now, this idea of isomorphism is that we cannot distinguish between isomorphic manifolds. And isomorphic here means either homeomorphic or diffeomorphic, depending on what you're talking about. By which I mean, if you have two manifolds that are homeomorphic and you only look at their topological properties, you cannot distinguish them. You cannot tell me which one is which anymore. And if you think back to the various examples I've given you of just a set that is the same as another set just by moving points around. At some point, I think I told you that you can make any set that has the cardinality of the real numbers into the real line, topologically speaking. The idea is that you can always rename stuff and make it into something different. Homeomorphisms carry, in addition to the renaming, also the topological structure. And of course, this is assuming that there is not any extra structure on the manifold. You can have two manifolds that are homeomorphic or diffeomorphic, but they have extra stuff on top of that that's not preserved anymore. And that's actually what happens in this case here. You can have two manifolds that are homeomorphic. On top of the topological structure, they have the differential structure. And if the two differential structures are not the same, then even though they are homeomorphic, you end up with two different objects. So this is something to keep in mind, generally speaking. Any questions about this?
Can you repeat this last part about distinguished isomorphic manifolds?
Yes. So you can have manifolds which are homeomorphic. And this means that you cannot distinguish them as topological manifolds. But if you have extra structure, that may allow you to distinguish them. So for example, if you have two homeomorphic manifolds that have different differential structure, which is something that can happen. And if you're interested in looking about this, for example, you can look about exotic spheres, which is an example of this. It's what we call these spheres that are the same as far as spheres go, topologically speaking, but then they actually have different differential structures. You can distinguish them. You can tell, well, this is actually different than the other one because there's something more. They are not just topological manifolds. They are smooth manifolds, which is something extra.
But if the two manifolds are diffeomorphic, then you still can find like extra structure to differentiate them?
Yes. So if they are diffeomorphic, can you put extra structure on them? Of course. So there are smooth manifolds, which are just what we defined. And then you can add whatever you want on top of them. You can make them into Riemannian manifolds, so they have a metric. And then you need to preserve that as well if you want them to be exactly equivalent. Or you can make them into symplectic manifold. So you can add a lot of extra things on a manifold. And then if you want to preserve that, you need some extra condition. So it's not just diffeomorphic. It's diffeomorphic and it preserved the symplectic structure. So then you have symplectomorphisms and so on. So this can get bigger and bigger. Just as for vector spaces, you can have an inner product, and then you need to have a map that also preserves the inner product. It's not enough to just have an isomorphism. OK, so let me give you a couple of examples of this. So you should have actually seen these yesterday at the tutorial, but I'll just give you a map in case you use something different. The cylinder defined like this. So it's a vertical cylinder centered at the origin with radius 1, and it's infinite. So it goes up and down all the way. This is a manifold. And we can give it just one chart, which is this one. We're going to map x, y, z in this cylinder to the points e to the z times x, e to the z times y in the punctured plane. And it's not easy to see that this map is going to map the whole cylinder to the whole punctured plane. Because we can take any x and y in the circle, but then we can rescale that circle to make it as big or as little as we want by changing z with the exponential map. But this is never going to actually give you 0. So you can reach any point but the origin. And then you can make the circle bigger and bigger, and it's going to reach all the way to infinity. So this one chart makes it into a manifold, because manifolds with just one chart automatically satisfy everything. There are no transition maps. But also, this map phi is a diffeomorphism between the cylinder and the punctured plane. And to see this, we're going to look at the coordinate representations. Now, the punctured plane is a manifold using the identity map, because it's an open subset of Rn, or R2 in this case. So the only coordinate maps, there's only two of them because you only have two charts. One chart on the cylinder, one chart on the puncture plane. And so the only possible maps, one of them is for the map phi, and the other one is for the map phi to the minus one. The coordinate representations are identity composed with phi composed with phi to the minus one. This is the equivalent of the one that before looked like psi composed f composed with phi to the minus one. And the other one for the inverse map is going to be phi composed f to the minus one composed phi to the minus one, but this time phi to the minus one goes between n and m. So we're really mixing things around. So the only possible coordinate representations are identity composed phi with composed phi to the minus one, but this is the identity again. And phi composed phi to the minus one composed the identity to the minus one, which is still the identity. So there's only one coordinate representation for each one of them, and it's the identity map. The identity map is continuous and smooth and whatever you want. So this means that this is a diffeomorphism. So from the point of view of geometry, a cylinder is exactly the same as the punctured plane. And graphically, what you are thinking of is you have this cylinder, and then you are stretching it out. You are stretching out the points on top, and the points below z equals 0, you are instead pushing them closer and closer, and then you squish the whole thing down. And eventually, this gives you this punctured plane. The other example is the open interval, minus 1 to 1. This is a manifold because it's an open subset of R. And this is diffeomorphic to R itself. And the diffeomorphism is just, for example, the arctan H function that sends minus 1 to 1 to the whole real numbers. Because remember, tan H, if you just look at tan H, it sends all of the numbers. The domain is the whole of R, but the graph looks like this. It never reaches 1 and minus 1, but gets asymptotically closer to 1 on the right and minus 1 on the left. So the inverse is going to send everything between minus 1 and 1, excluding minus 1 and 1, to the real numbers. And this is a continuous and differentiable map. Now, I like this example because it shows something interesting. The open interval and R are the same topologically and as smooth manifold. But intuitively, you might think the minus 1 to 1 is smaller than R because it's just a finite, well, not finite, it's still, there's infinitely many points, but it has minus 1 to 1. It should be a lot smaller than R, but it's not. They are exactly the same, and you cannot distinguish them. Because all we're doing with this map, Arctan H, is we are changing names to the points. We are essentially calling minus 1 minus infinity, 1 plus infinity. That's all we're doing, and we're stretching it. So this intuitive idea is not actually correct. And that's why we need topology to describe this kind of thing. So for example, compactness is the property of, instead of using this, if we add minus 1 to 1 as a closed interval, then this is actually different than R as a topological space. And this is going to be a compact manifold, which we haven't defined, but just as a notion, is something very different from R. So you actually get different behaviors, and as manifolds, they are not going to be diffeomorphic. So you do need this extra structure to tell you things about sets. You cannot just rely on the notions of, well, this is a subset of R, I kind of know how it works. Okay, so that was all about these smooth and continuous maps. Are there any questions before we move on to bundles? OK, we'll see more of this at tutorial anyway, so you'll get a chance to practice more of these things. All right, so bundles there's many ways to define bundles and introduce them for our purposes. Because we're looking at specific bundles, I'm only going to talk about the tangent, cotangent, and tensor bundles. And the motivation for introducing them is going to be this one. We want to talk about, for example, vector fields, and also covector fields, tensor fields, but the idea is the same. Now, vector fields are intuitively something which assigns to each point P in M a vector which is tangent to M at the point. So at P, we assign V in TPM. However, we want to do this in a smooth way, not just assigning random vectors to stuff. We want to do this in such a way that if we change M, if we change P smoothly, then the vector changes smoothly. But we don't know how to do that, because this is going to be a map that goes from M to some set, but we only know how to say something is smooth if that set we're sending to is a manifold. So what we need to do is to put all of the possible tangent vectors all in one bucket, and that bucket is not just any random bucket, it needs to be a manifold. Because then we know how to say that the map that maps the point P to a vector in that bucket is a smooth map. So that's what bundles are going to be. They're going to be these buckets with the structure of a manifold. So that's what we're trying to do. Let's start with the tangent ones. We're going to leave this just a bit longer so you can write if you're still writing. OK, so the tangent bundle is going to be defined like this. So first of all, we denote it by TM. It's almost the same as the tangent space TPM, but we're getting rid of the point because it has all of them. It's going to contain all of the possible tangent vectors at all possible points. We're going to define it in this way. Now, this symbol here is the disjoint union. So we are taking the union of all of the tangent spaces, but in a disjoint way. So this just means that we're making sure that we still know where to identify the points that came, the each vector we want to identify where it came from. The reason why we need to do this is that all of the TPMs, all of these spaces, are all isomorphic. So if you want to actually be able to know where a vector came from, we need to attach to it a label that says this vector came from TPM. And the way this is done, this disjoint union, is this. So specifically, we take a union. Instead of taking just a union of TPM, we take the union of the singleton of P times TPM. So these are all essentially just unions of TPM, but they have a label attached to it. So it's a set that also remembers, hey, I'm based at P, not any other point. And as a set, this is going to be the set of all the points PV, where P is in M, but V is in TPM. So you can never have a pair PV where V is based somewhere else. It's always going to be, if I give you PV in TM, then you know always that V belongs to TPM. That's what we're trying to say with this disjoint union.
So you say disjoint union just because you were taking the Cartesian product of that point, like times the TPM, the corresponding TPM, right?
Yes, we're calling it disjoint union because we're taking, instead of the union of these sets directly, we're taking the union of these sets. Now, this is important because, for example, if you are working with Rn as a manifold, the tangent spaces are all always Rn. And if you take the union of all of them, then you just get one copy of Rn. That's not what you're looking for. You want to know where the vectors came from. So you need to take this disjoint union.
And know where, like, where did that TPM came from? Like, why do you need to know the point B?
So why do we need to know it? And that's what I was saying right now. So if you have TRN, for example, this is going to be the disjoint union or between two PEs in Rn, but then TPM is just Rn itself.
Okay, but yeah, but if
well, if you don't do that, if you don't take this union, but you take this union instead, then because you're taking the union of the same set all over, this is just Rn. And that's not good. That's not what you're looking for. Because it only has one copy of Rn. You want to make sure that you distinguish all these things because these vector spaces are all isomorphic. So you really, you cannot distinguish them. The only way you can distinguish them is if you attach to them this label. And so they have this extra structure of remembering that they come from P.
I understand like that you're doing this to distinguish them, but I just don't understand exactly why it's useful to distinguish them.
So why do we use this particular way to label them?
Why is it useful to know, to trace back where that P, like the point P? Like, do you need this in the future for some
reason? We did this for a few reasons. One of them is we want to build, remember, fields that map from P to V in TPM. Which means if I map P to V, essentially, I need to make sure that V comes from P, is based at P. And the way we know it is if it's, when it's in here, it needs to have the label P next to it. So it is important to remember. And also it turns out that this set, it's very useful to have the P in there as well for applications in classical mechanics. That if we have time, I'm going to show you at the end. Okay, so this is the set. It is a bit weird the way we define it, but now that we defined it, we can make it into a manifold, which is our goal. To make it into a manifold, we need to build an atlas, and we're going to build it by using the atlas of M and building upon that. So suppose that U phi is a chart for M. Then we're going to build a chart out of this one. We call it U tilde phi tilde. And this is going to be a chart for the tangent bundle. The set U tilde is going to be defined like this. It's going to be the disjoint union of the various TPMs, but not for all the points, just for the points in U. So it's just a subset of the tangent bundle. Specifically, it's going to be all the PV in the tangent bundle, such that P is in U, not anywhere else, so that we can give it coordinates using this map phi. And V is in the tangent space TPM. So that part is the same. And then the map phi tilde is going to be defined like this. We have PV in this set U tilde. Then how do we give it coordinates? Well, the point P is going to be given coordinates by just using phi. That's easy because phi gives coordinates to M. But how do we give coordinates to the vector v? Well, that's also easy because remember, if we have a coordinate chart, we can give a basis to the tangent space. And if you have a basis to the tangent space, we can map these bases to Rn because the basis was actually obtained by stealing it from Rn in the first place. Or if you want, remember that map d5p was actually an isomorphism between TPM and Rn. So we already have a nice map that goes from the tangent space to Rn, so we use it to give coordinates to vectors. And so we are giving n coordinates here, n coordinates here, so we're mapping to Rn times Rn. Another way of looking at this is this one. If we have the pair PV and we write it as P, and then V, we just write it in components with respect to a basis. So this is just a linear combination of the basis elements defined by the chart. So here we're assuming that phi is of the form x1, x2, xn. So any V can be written as a linear combination of these. Then when we act with the map of d5p on it, we're going to get exactly those coordinates, v1, v2, to vn. So that's what we're doing with with this map. And this is actually going to be a chart. And if we put them all together, it's going to be an atlas. And the reason why, so the answer to the question is this an atlas? Well, let's check. First of all, it does cover TM. So we can check this. Because of the way we defined it, we have U tilde is the union, disjoint union when P is in U. But then, because all of the U's cover M, if we take the union of all of these things, they are still going to cover the tangent space. So the part checks. D5P is a nice map. It's an invertible linear map. And the codomain is Rn, which is an open subset of Rn. And also, if phi and psi are overlapping charts, and they both contain P, then the transition map is smooth. And the reason why is that if you look at this, which is half of the invertible, the transition map, so if you take d phi p composed with d psi p to the minus 1, well, this is actually a map that goes from Rn to Rn, and it's invertible, and it's a linear map. Because this is a linear map, this is a linear map. If you compose them, they are still linear. It goes from Rn to Rn, but linear maps from Rn to Rn, they are always smooth and continuous. So this means that no matter what, the thing we build is going to be an atlas. And so this means that we can make M into a manifold, a TM into a manifold. One extra thing that we're going to need later is the definition of the projection on TM. So a projection is just a way, because we have points P, V in TM, we want to project this pair on M. And the natural way of doing it is just pick up the first entry. So we have this map pi that to P, V in TM associates P in M. It's a boring function, but it's very useful for what we need to do later. Is this thing clear? So just to recap, we have TM is built out of disjoint unions of TM. So in a sense, it has all of the tangent vectors, but it also knows where they are based. And then we can make it into a manifold by just extending the chart for M and mapping the vectors to their components in the coordinate basis. And the cotangent bundle and the tensor bundles work exactly the same. In fact, I'm going to go very fast on them. And all we need is these four lines for each one of them. The cotangent bundle, same definition, disjoint unions. But instead of the tangent spaces, we use the cotangent spaces. And the charts are going to be built almost the same. So U tilde is going to be the disjoint union with P in U of T star PM. Now, the charts, the actual maps phi tilde, they are going to map a covector, which is always something of this form. You have alpha I, and then you have the basis that comes from the coordinates, dxi at p. And to this, we just associate the various components here, go a1 all the way to an. And you can prove again, just the same way as above, that this is still going to give you an atlas. Because this map, the one that maps this to this, is still going to be a linear map. Then you can invert it, you compose them, and you get a map from Rn to Rn. The projection looks the same. You have P alpha in T star M, and this is going to map to P in M. The tensor bundles are exactly the same. They're just quite difficult to write down because of all the possible components, but it behaves exactly the same. So you have this notation here, we're removing the point P, just as before. So we have this TRSM. This is the tensor bundle of type RS. We take the disjoint union of all the tensor spaces of type RS for all the points. Then u tilde is going to be given again by the disjoint union only with p ranging over u. And phi tilde is going to map the point p and the vector and the tensor. This very ugly thing. I recommend not writing down this thing because it takes a lot of time to write all these things. So you have all the possible components, and there's a lot of them. You're going to have r times s components here. And then you have the basis in coordinates for the tensor space, which is a tensor product of the basis for the tangent space and the cotangent space. And to this, you're just going to map all of these components, which are just real numbers. And I'm just putting them in this notation, just means this is the set of all possible of them. There's a lot of them, so I cannot write them all. And this time, we are going to get n times r times s possible components, because there's r times s indices. Each one of them goes from 1 to n. And so we're mapping to rn times rn rs. The projection works exactly the same. And again, you can prove this is a manifold with exactly the same steps as above.
Yes. Can I ask something? In this way that you define this manifold, I feel I kind of know the answer, but I want to hear again. But I feel you kind of have the whole manifold and directly product Rn to that manifold, right? So it's kind of a boring manifold. It doesn't change anything. But it's not like that, right?
Yeah, so you're saying, so this manifold kind of looks like you are just taking m times Rn, right? So it's not just like that, but it's very similar. And that's the idea of a bundle. So I didn't define bundles in general, but if you want to define bundles, they're just called fiber bundles. And they are things that look like the manifold times some other space. In this case, the spaces are the tangent spaces.
But can you give an intuition why these two manifolds are different? Because the way you define is like you just concatenate Rn. Like, I cannot see why this...
Yeah, so the reason why this one is not exactly the same is that when you map it in coordinates, it looks like the product of two things. But if you look at the whole manifold, it is not true in general that Tm, for example, it's not going to be just the product of m times something. And that something, for example, could be Rn. It's not just as easy as this. It locally looks like this, but it's not exactly like this in general. And that's because the tangent spaces are different at each point. So you are attaching at each point a different tangent space. Of course, when you map them, locally it's going to look like this. So these bundles are something that locally looks like products, but globally don't. And that's why you need manifolds. Yes?
I'm wondering would it help to see the example of the tangent space of the sphere? It's, you know, embedded in Rn, and you can kind of really see it. But
yes. Right, so as Kevin is saying, if you just think of the sphere in Rn, or we can do the circle in R2 because it's going to be simpler, I can draw it easily. At each point, you're going to have the tangent line now. And at different points, you're going to have different tangent lines. So this is not just the same as taking the circle times r, because if you do that, it's going to look like a cylinder.
But I think the tangent bundle of circle is actually cylinder, right? It's not? In this specific example, they are equal. But there should be another example.
Right, I had to think about this. Now I'm getting confused. You're right, and I'm getting confused. So I'll think about this. We can talk about it later. But in general, this is not always going to be true. So there are some bundles that, of course, look exactly like this, and some bundles that don't look like this. So there are trivial bundles and non-trivial bundles. So generally, this is not always going to be just the trivial thing, but in some cases it's going to be non-trivial. In many interesting cases, it's going to be non-trivial. And in any case, bundles in general can be weird things. And you're going to see at the end of the course specific bundles that you use for gauge theory. But right now we're only hearing about these very specific examples that are needed to talk about fields. So these are just some very small subset of all the possible bundles that you can build. And we're building them this way for a reason. So at the end of the day, the important thing is that these are manifolds. And the structure that we given to them is just coming from the manifold itself. So they are not just random products, because we are using the structure on them to construct this thing. Okay, so now that we have these things, we can construct fields. And that's almost the answer. We're actually going to be able to finish this in time. So remember, the idea was we have these sets that contain all possible vectors at all possible points, and we want to map each point to a vector in a smooth way. So to do this, we're going to consider a smooth map for a vector field. We're going to call it capital X, just because it's a common notation for vector fields on a manifold, but you can call it V or whatever letter you want. It's going to go from some subset U that should be open. Now, technically, we didn't really talk about open subsets of a manifold, because I didn't explicitly tell you what the topology of the manifold is. But I told you you can just give it to a manifold using the atlas. So this is just for completeness. For now, you can avoid worrying about this thing. You can just think of the field going from the whole M to Tm, for example. So the codomain is going to be Tm, which is our set of all possible vectors. But it needs to satisfy this thing. The projection composed with the map X should be the identity. This is just a fancy way of saying that X of P should be of the form P, B, not some other point. Because this is the same as saying that pi of X of P equals P. And remember, pi just picks up the first component. So we are saying that this thing here should be P. These things are also called sections of Tm. Whenever you have a bundle, you can construct a thing that's called a section, which is essentially a function that goes from the manifold to the bundle with the property that the projection composed with the function gives you the identity.
Could you repeat what a section is?
Yes, so a section is exactly this. A section is a map that goes from some subset open of the manifold to the bundle, such that the projection composed with X is the identity. So section is the same as vector field. It's just that the section can be defined on any bundle. A vector field is a specific kind of section. It's a section of the tangent bundle. It's just that I didn't tell you what the section is, so I couldn't just tell you a vector field is a section of the tangent bundle and leave it at that. So this is just for nomenclature, so you know if you find someone telling you about sections of a bundle later, you know what they are and how they're related to vector fields. A covector field is the same idea. You have some map, and I'm giving them these Greek letters alpha because that's what you usually do for covector fields. So it's going to be a section of the cotangent bundle, or a map that goes from some subset of M to the cotangent bundle, such that the projection composed with this map gives you the identity. So this is needed just because, remember, we want to make sure that at every point we associate a vector or a covector and so on based at that point. That's what we're doing here. We're requiring that we're not just assigning any vector, but we want a vector based exactly at the point. And a tensor field is, again, the same thing. tensor field of type RS is going to be a section of the tangent the tensor bundle of type RS. So we get some map, call it T, between the manifold and the tensor bundle, such that the projection composed with this map gives you the identity. So that's how you define this these functions. That's why we needed bundles in the first place. And just to reiterate why this is important, we're always saying smooth here. And the only way we're able to say that these maps are smooth is because both M and, for example, here the tensor bundle, they're both manifolds. If they were not manifolds, we would not know how to say that these things are smooth. That's why we needed them to be manifolds. And of course, we're not showing all of this because we don't have time to prove all these things. But the reason why we define things this way is that this is consistent. If we just add things that live in Rn, so that all of the spaces are just copies of Rn many times, then we will get exactly the same results. So this whole thing that we're doing is consistent with just doing this in Euclidean space. And in a sense, it generalizes Euclidean space. Although we're not showing any of this. You're just going to have to trust me on this. Some notes to keep in mind about this. We're calling them vector fields, covector fields, and so on. And it would be nice if they were actual vectors, covectors, and tensors, which are all a form of vectors. So we should be able to add them and scale them. And in fact, if you consider the set of all the possible vector fields, all the possible covector fields, or tensor fields, independently, these form vector spaces. And the operations are going to be defined like this. If you have, I'm just going to use vector fields here, but you can extend this to any other of these examples, so covectors and tensors. If I have x and y as vector fields, and I want to do a linear combination of them, I define it like this. It's going to be a new field that when you evaluate it at p, just gives you this. You're going to get the point p at the beginning because it's still based at the same point. And then you just do the linear combination at the level of the tangent space where you know how to do things because it's a vector space. And here these xp and yp are exactly these components here. So if you write x evaluated at p, you're going to get a pair p xp. Xp is the second element of the pair. And yp is the second element of the pair. To just replace these with covectors or tensors, and you're going to get the same definition. So we can actually make them into vector spaces, which is great. And this also means that we can give them bases. And the way we give them a basis is, again, using coordinates. So as usual, consider u pi as a chart in the manifold. And we're going to have this chart being split up in components as x1 all the way to xn. Then we can define these bases, which are going to look familiar because they're exactly the same as the basis for the tangent spaces, for example, but without that p subscript. So we have d over dxi. This is going to be now a vector field. So it's going to assign to a point p in u, which is the set where the chart is defined. It's going to assign the pair p, and then we assign to it this basis vector of tpm that we had defined before. And similarly, dxi without the subscript is going to be this map that assigns to p in u, p, and then it assigns dxi p. So at each point, it's going to attach exactly the vectors that we had given before. Now, of course, these things are supposed to be smooth, so we're not proving at all that they're smooth, but they end up actually being smooth. And then we have the one for tensors, which looks very ugly, so I really recommend not writing this down. But it's the same idea. You just take tensor products of these ones. And in fact, you could just not write this at all and just remember a definition of what a tensor product is. And just say, well, the basis for the tangent, the tensor bundle is just going to be products of the basis for the tangent bundle and the cotangent bundle.
Let's say if the whole vector space is all of vectors, covectors, and this, then we should also be able to add a vector and covector.
So are you asking whether we can add a vector and a covector?
Yeah. Because if you're saying the whole thing is a vector space.
So I might have confused you earlier. So the vectors on their own form a vector space. The covectors form another vector space. The tensors form another vector space. In fact, tensors of different ranks form different. Now, that does not mean that you cannot build vector spaces where you have both vectors and covectors. You can do that. But it's another thing. You're taking direct sums of vector spaces, and then you can have both kinds of things in it, for example. But that's a different structure that we're not looking at all. But you could do that. And for example, you can do that for differential forms. You can have one vector space that has all of the forms in it of different dimensions.
But in that case, we have the concept of wedge product or something that increases.
Yes. So there it makes sense. Right now, it doesn't really make sense. So you could do that, but there's no need to do it right now.
But here, what you mean is that separate vector spaces, each of them.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, so I realize this is a bit confusing. So sorry about that. I did say individually, but didn't write it down. So. OK, so we're ready for examples, unless there are any questions. We only have a couple of minutes left, so let's go to the examples. OK, so we're already seeing the metric tensor at the individual tangent space level. But now we can actually look at it on the whole manifold. So a pseudo-Riemannian metric tensor is just going to be a tensor field. The classic letter is G. That to a point in M associates this pair P, GP, and now this is going to be a tensor field of rank 0, 2. And we want it to be defined on the whole manifold. So it should go from any point in M to something in here. And because it's a tensor field, it needs to be smooth. So you're probably seeing these as definitions of the tensor. It's essentially something that smoothly attaches to every point this tensor that works on two vectors, or this scalar product idea. And that's exactly what we're doing using the bundles. So each of these GP is going to be an element of the tensor space of rank 0, 2 at point P. And each of these should be symmetric and non-degenerate. And this is what gives you the pseudo-Riemannian metric. If you want to be just Riemannian, then you replace non-degenerate with positive definite. And in coordinates, we're going to use those bases that we built before. So we can write that G at the point P is going to be these coordinates G mu of P, which we already defined last time. And then we have the basis of this tensor bundle, all the tensor fields of this rank, and it's going to be dx mu times dx mu with the tensor product. And if you don't remember, that's how we define the coordinates. So they're just going to be the tensor GP that's defined at the point, and you evaluate it on the basis. This should be mu. So the basis dx mu at the point and dx nu at the point. Now, one important thing to notice is that this coordinate description only works on, in general, a subset of the whole manifold. So you cannot use this description in general to describe the whole metric tensor everywhere. If you have different patches, you're going to have to use different coordinates on the different patches and then patch them up in a nice way. So this, in general, doesn't happen, that these basis fields are going to be defined on the whole manifold. In fact, it's not guaranteed ever, unless you have some very special conditions, that you can even find a basis that's defined everywhere, like a basis vector field or a basis of vector fields. For generic manifolds, that's not guaranteed that you can build one. What you can do is always build one locally and then another one locally and another one locally and then patch them up. That you can do, which is why we need this whole structure that we have given. Okay, so I had another example, but I have no time. It is in the lecture notes though. So if you're interested, you can look it up there. So that's it. And I hope you enjoyed the first part and have fun with the rest of the course.